Welcome to Alaska's Native Voice. I'm Antonia Gonzalez from the National Congress of American Indians mid-year gathering at the Dena'ina Center in Anchorage. At NCAI, tribal leaders, advocates, and young people, and many others are gathered to discuss everything from climate change to litigation and how it directly impacts their communities. That's why we're talking about science and Indigenous women in the field. We're talking to women leading the way in their communities to help heal, adapt, and strengthen the resilience through science, technology, engineering, and math. We'll also learn how these things are used in our everyday life, especially when it comes to environmental issues. And joining me now are Yotsi Storms and Danielle Stickman. Thank you for joining us. Danielle, please introduce yourself.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. My name is Danielle Stickman. I am Dena'ina and Koyokon Athabaskan. My mother is from Nundalton in Bristol Bay, and my father is from Galena on the Yukon River. And I am the Alaska State Deputy Director for the Wilderness Society, and happy to be here today. Chinon.
Thank you. And Yotsi?
Hi, good morning. My name is Yosti Storms. My Inupiaq name is Alegak. I'm from Unalakleet, but I live here in Anchorage, and I am a senior director for the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, and I manage our middle school component.
Well, thank you both for being here, and why don't you tell us a little bit how you got involved in STEM and working in STEM?
So I was first introduced, well, I think STEM is everywhere. You know, being a Native person, I think we practice STEM. But when I was attending Mount Edgecombe High School, my 11th grade year, we had two people from ANSEP come, and they got us excited by introducing the computer build. So I started actually out with ANSEP as a high school student doing the computer build. And after that, they offered all these different opportunities that really excited me. I wasn't really too sure about studying STEM at the university level until that. And then, so afterwards, I did the computer build, and then I did their Summer Bridge component. And as a Summer Bridge student, I was able to do an internship with the Norton Sound Economic Development Corporation in Unalakleet, which was super awesome, being able to do a fisheries project or help with the fisheries project. And then after doing a series of internships with NSCDC, the North Slope Borough Department of Wildlife, and USGS, I graduated from the university in 2015 and started with the program in 2016 as a regional director, you know, doing middle school, the middle school component. And then during COVID, became a senior director and have been doing what I've been doing for like almost 7 years.
Wow, that's great. And Danielle, how did you get into the field?
So I went to most of my schooling in Fairbanks and also in the village. And then I went to middle school and high school here in Anchorage and got involved in what is now well known as the International Baccalaureate Program at West High. We were the first cohort to try that international program, and it gets you involved in a bunch of fields. It starts preparing you for high school. So the science classes were really intense, and it just increased my interest in science. And then I got involved in what is called the American Fisheries Society Hutton Junior Scholars Program, which assigns high school students who are in their junior and senior years with a scientist at a local, state, or federal entity or a place that studies fisheries. So I did 2 years of an internship at the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, and it also, it just increased my interest in sciences. And like Yosti said, when you live in the village and you're so close with the environment, it's natural to be curious about everything. I grew up at fish camp where you see the fish go from a little fry that you see in the water, and it grows as an adult. And so in high school, I got to actually go back to my community. They allowed me to partner with the Park Service back there to actually help tag whitefish and see how the whitefish migrate around the lake and see how our people have been helping the whitefish, and the whitefish have been helping the people by the traditional fish camps. So the whitefish are known to go back to the fish camp areas because they know that they could get food there. And then in the wintertime, they go up north to the northern side of the lake. And so that really just really increased my interest and furthered my it was so fun to see all the fish that I would catch every summer and learn about their life. And it just created more and more lessons that are integrated into my culture. And so I went to the University of Hawaii at Hilo for environmental science. And the being on a small island with such small land, it really made me appreciate how much land we have in Alaska and how much we can learn from all of the different cultures here. But it also made me appreciate the Hawaiian cultures and how they steward their small lands and learned about the fish ponds and their language is integrated in their conservation of their lands and in their sciences. And so it just increased my thirst to come back to Alaska and learn from my own culture, not only the language, but more about how we have stewarded the resources, or not the resources, the animals and the lands for thousands of years. And so I came back and have worked around the state for over a decade.
That's great. I love how you sound your interest. Yotsi, what was your interest? Danielle was talking about what got her interested in getting into the field. What do you think sparked your interest?
I think a lot of it has to do with subsistence. So in Unalakleet, people rely on the ocean resources, the land, the river. And so part of growing up in Unalakleet, that's a big part of our identity is being able to do subsistence. And so I think just caring about that and caring about how that's a big part of being an Alaska Native person really interested me in science and caring about it because it matters.
And, how do you help, other people spark their interest? How can people, for someone who's maybe not, doesn't know a lot about the field, how do you help spark their interest and make it maybe less scary or less intimidating?
I think it's really important just to recognize that, yes, STEM is everywhere. Science is everywhere. We're all a little bit like scientists, right? But working at the middle school level, I think, just getting students excited about, what's out there and what the possibilities are, what's available to them in the sciences, I think, has been a really big, important role that I've had. So when students are invited or when they participate in our middle school component, starting with the middle school academy, our job is to get them excited and introduce them to a bunch of different STEM activities. So all the activities we do at the middle school level are all hands-on. One of the first things the students get to do is build their own personal computer with the intent that they're going to complete Algebra 1 before entering high school. So really, getting them excited about all that. And then also having different people come in. So we have different partners, like university professors, partners with the Renewable Energy Alaska Project. They come in and they do hands-on activities with the students, and so students get that, that learning opportunity, and they get to ask those instructors questions, and I think that really helps, build their enthusiasm for science, technology, engineering, and math.
And Danielle, same thing. How do you see, encouraging and sparking that interest at an early age?
For other people or just for myself? Okay. I also was a part of what I went to the University of Hawaii at Hilo on the Big Island. And so the Big Island has almost all of the ecosystems and except for tundra, it even has snow. And so I also was a part of the program called Kealoha Scholars, which focuses on Alaska Native American Indian and Pacific Islanders who are in STEM programs, and they were really inclusive of our cultures. And so when you're in a community or from a place that is so interdependent with the environment and the seasons, and you come and you share about science, it has to be integrated in a way that is also applicable to the area. So I'm about to go to a leadership camp for middle school and high school kids in my home region on Saturday, and my mom's an anthropologist, and she's been leading it for almost a decade. And so what I've noticed is what really gets the kids excited is, number one, listening to them and really hearing their interests and kind of tapping into their own potential of what they don't even know what they can do. And it's just like Yosti said, getting them excited about the, like, a computer or math, and it's tapping into their interests and knowing that they're supported by those who are in the field and who also enjoy it, and also it is relevant to their culture, and it could be applied to different areas. And I can think of how my great uncle can tell a tree how a tree is healthy to prepare to make snowshoes or a sled, and in his way, his also applying science of an understanding of different species and how it bends to be able to make snowshoes. And so all of these different things, it's all interconnected. And so tapping into what really gets the youth excited.
And it also seems like there's an effort to increase interest among young women and get into the field and have more young or more opportunities for including going to college. There's a lot of opportunities for women to get into STEM as well. We talked to Fawn Sharp, who is the president of the National Congress of American Indians, about why this is important. Our producer, Emily Schwing, had a chance to talk to her. Let's hear what Fawn Sharp has to say.
What do you think what the future role of Indigenous women in doing this work is?
Yes, the future role is very bright. When I look at the next generation of women leaders, they are part of a generation that's born into a society where they can learn their languages, where they could go out on a canoe and tribal journeys. And so our goal for this generation is to ensure that the difficult path that we've had to walk, facing misogyny, and I always say if my name was Frank Sharp, it would be so much easier. And it seems like I have to work twice as hard, probably 10 times as hard. And that's a reality. And it's a reality not only for Indigenous women leaders, but all across the spectrum. I mean, I remember hearing about, Vice President Kamala Harris. And gosh, if I was a male, I would have had a different reception to some of the things. And so it permeates throughout public life for women. But we want to be that generation that says, you know, we don't want that next generation to experience what we've had to experience. And to the extent we could be truthful about that and confront the misogyny, it's going to make it better for those girls who are watching. And so I think we're pretty, you know, tough and strong and solid, but that next generation coming up is.
I mean, Indigenous women are very tough women.
Yes, yes.
Someone said to me yesterday, oh, the future is female. Do you think the Indigenous future is female?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes.
And that was Fawn Sharp. That was Fawn Sharp with the president. That was Fawn Sharp, National Congress of American Indians president, talking about women in STEM. What did you guys think about what she had to say?
I'm excited about the future, just working with middle school students and seeing their potential. That gives me hope, and just seeing how when they first get to our program and then they leave, just seeing how much they learn and how much confidence they have, that really inspires me. And that gives me, like, that hope that the future is going to be amazing for everyone.
And Danielle?
I really enjoyed what she had to share, and I do believe that the future is female.
Sorry about that. We're having a little bit of technical problems. Just a moment. Okay, go ahead, Danielle.
No worries. It's like Zoom calls in the early stages of COVID. All good. I really appreciated what she had to share, and also what Yosti had to share. I think it's the future is for everyone, and women have helped. There are so many female leaders right now who are so inspiring, and I also, they do so much. They're not only leaders in sciences or politics or healing circles or so much research, but they're also mothers and grandmothers and aunties, and they're also creatives. There are so many Indigenous women and women in general who I know are work in their field, but then they've got a side gig of doing beading or healing walks or yoga or, and so it's so wonderful that we're multi-talented and multifaceted because it will help help others to know that there's not just one way to do this and change. And it's so wonderful because it's a very a holistic way of approaching all of this, and I really appreciate that, and I do believe that there's space for both, and I think the future is transforming in a really good way.
And also just what she said about, you know, providing those opportunities, and I think these programs like you work in definitely do that. And how do you help encourage girls in particular?
I think we're building, you know, we're encouraging them to be role models. So starting at the middle school level and supporting them on even up to the PhD level, we're creating those role models and we're creating that representation that, you know, any little girl could be a professor or any little girl could be an engineer. So I think that's what we're trying to change, is just the hiring practices of Indigenous people in STEM.
And also just hearing from people here at the National Congress of American Indians this week, and just it's being held the mid-year here because there are a number of tribes. There's nearly half of all the federally recognized tribes are located here in Alaska, so a lot of the agenda was Alaska focused on different environmental issues, climate change, subsistence, a lot of issues facing tribes here in Alaska, and also similar issues that tribes in the lower 48 are facing as well. So Danielle, with studying and going to different places and using your Indigenous knowledge and learning from others, what does that do? How does that help in this field?
Learning from all the others? It helps so much because just like Fawn said, I think in this field I don't think I was prepared for some of the misogyny that I did experience in my early stages of my career of working with a different federal state and others that were not used to seeing a young Indigenous woman with a college degree enter into a room filled with scientists. I got some comments that were just inappropriate and just represented ignorance of some others, and so it's It taught me to give others the benefit of the doubt, but also not to take it, and also speak up and when appropriate. And in between my careers, I've gone to different countries. I went to Nepal and hiked to the base camp of Everest, and I've also been to Spain and walked 500 miles. And I like going to different countries to experience how locals have traditionally walked and where they went, and it's a different it's such a different pace being in the mountains in Nepal and in Spain. It reminded me to slow down like our ancestors did and recognize what is all around us and realize that everyone is coming to the table with different experiences and different backgrounds, and so when it comes to STEM and entering this field for young women, remembering that our ancestors are with us. All the knowledge that they had is in our DNA, and it's also from the foods that we eat. The salmon that I ate, my great 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 grandmother ate, and so all of this is within us. And remembering that we have all of our cultures supporting us in this work.
And I think that's a really good point, as well as having all the cultures represented, and definitely having kids from all over the state come in and share, even though they're from different regions. How do you see that play out, and what kind of conversations and learning goes on when a bunch of people from all over the state get together?
Oh, at ANSEP, I feel like we're all about community, and so having people from all over the state, we bring like a little bit of ourselves, and we share that with each other, and I really think having that community helps all the students be successful. So, you know, when we come to Anchorage or go to Fairbanks to go to school to get our STEM degrees, you know, being away from home, you're not going to be able to take your village with you, but, you know, going to places that are being in part of programs like ANSEP that can offer you that community, it really helps you feel not like home is with you in a way, and it helps you be successful.
Definitely some of the conversations when tribal leaders are here, advocates, other people, having indigenous people not only be at the table, but through the processes, whether it's policy or decision making. And that's definitely the same when it comes to science, and indigenous people across, you know, Alaska and in the lower 48 have been impacted in the past negatively when researchers who are non-native from outside the community come in. Our producer, Emily Schwing, got a chance to talk to a student from the University of Oklahoma, and he talked a little bit about why it's so important for Native communities to be involved.
My name is Jared Blackbear. I'm from the University of Oklahoma. I'm a senior studying management information systems there under the Price College of Business. And I'm a part of the genomics and ethics for Native American students. So with genomics and ethics, I feel like it's important because our DNA is a pretty hot topic for a lot of different researchers. And so I wanted to get involved to see what that was like, see what the process is like. And it was really interesting to learn the ethics behind how you get those genomic specimens and how they're kept, because there's a lot of policy around it. And it's really important that we as Native people understand that policy so we can make sure our tribes do not get taken advantage of, because that's been an issue in the past whenever tribes work with different governmental entities on IRB projects.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, you know, finding like positive applications for genetic, you know, science.
The first foremost part of even starting an indigenous IRB is to ensure that the tribe does receive something out of it, because you don't want a researcher just coming in, getting all that research, producing their thesis, and never coming back to the tribe and giving them like that research, that data that they were promised. So a lot of indigenous IRB tribal boards have been established within different tribes. The Cherokee Nation has one, so they ensure that if they work with any researcher, that it comes back to the tribe in some way to help the people, because we're not just test subjects for IRBs. So
if you had a little kid come up to you right now and say, why should I get involved in science, what advice would you give them?
Because it's important, because you deserve that opportunity, because what you know and how you feel is important. So it's really important that they are able to convey those emotions to the outside world, that they're able to have a voice in different fields of study.
And that was a university student out of Oklahoma talking about the importance of tribes leading the way, really, and the way it should be done correctly. And there have been definitely stuff in the past, and maybe even currently, that, you know, hasn't had tribal approval. What did you think? Daniel, go ahead and go first.
I really appreciated his insights to that, the IRB process and having the tribes at the table, because there is a lot of past harm that has been done, and a lot of information that has been taken from tribes, and also artifacts. And so having the tribes be at the table and have a voice is so, so important. And also, not only providing the space for a voice, but also having those at the table be open and welcome to that voice is so, so important, because I've been in situations where they invite Indigenous perspectives and voices, and then it's not really considered equal to the other voices. And so reminding those spaces, or having some training of that, we have as much expertise as others, if not more, from living out on the land and seeing how everything changes, and just having the tribes be equitable. And I'll just say one thing. In many of the jobs I've had, it's been with wonderful leaders, but those who really encouraged me and supported me and helped me be where I am today, I appreciate all of them. But the ones who really got me to where I am today is the ones that trusted me to do the work that I was hired to do. And so I think having tribes be there, but and then trusting their knowledge is so, so important.
And that's a really, really great point, is not only having the trust, but building trust. I mean, sometimes in a lot of areas, you're building that trust, and it could take decades. Go ahead.
What was your question?
Yeah, just about the importance, adding to what Danielle was saying about tribes not only being at the table, but being open to working with others, but the trust-building aspect of it as well, and respecting Indigenous knowledge, because Indigenous knowledge goes back generations through generations, and having it looked at as the same as Western science and not any less.
Definitely, because, I mean, we have so much to offer. And, you know, the knowledge that we have has been passed down, and it can't be replaced. And it's just really important that it continues to get passed down and celebrated, not only just, you know, shared and like, oh, this is great, but celebrated and used and applied in everyday life.
Definitely. Well, we're here at the National Congress of American Indians Mid-Year Gathering taking place in Anchorage. There's tribal leaders wrapping up a few days of discussions here, including some of the issues we're talking about today, and making sure that tribes not only have a seat at the table, but they're involved in everything. And when something is introduced through the process all the way through the end, and there's a lot of resolutions passed this week, a lot of focus on climate and environmental issues. And today we're talking to some guests today about the importance of women in science, Indigenous women in science, and also just the value of traditional knowledge. And we're going to take a quick short break, and we'll be right back. It's just really short. Welcome back to Alaska's Native Voice. I'm Antonia Gonzalez, broadcasting from the National Congress of American Indians Mid-Year Conference taking place in Anchorage this week. I'd like to welcome back our guest to the program. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Hi, and everybody.
And right before the break, we were talking about Indigenous knowledge and the value of Indigenous knowledge, and just having other organizations, members in the science community, respecting that knowledge and just how it's passed down from generation to generation. Can you talk about that a little bit and how you see that being incorporated and trying to work with researchers?
Sure, I'll hop right in. So I mentioned my mother is an anthropologist, and so she was one of the few Alaska Native anthropologists, and so she's contributed so much to the region and works for the Park Service, and she's documented the language. And so the language of place names, and specific to mountains and lakes, are so important, because one of the rivers, the creeks that are at the headwaters of the lake, is named where the salmon spawn. But it's very, very, it's glacially silted. And so some biologists believe that the salmon wouldn't be able to find their way through all of that. But, I mean, the name of that stream is where the salmon spawn, and they didn't want to believe it. But then about a year or so ago, they actually did see that salmon do spawn in that lake, not the lake, the stream. And so going back to the indigenous place names of certain areas is so, so important, because there's a reason why we named certain places certain things, like where salmon spawn, where some of them are silly, but most of the time the place names are telling a story of why they would go there. Our people would migrate. We were nomadic, so we would go with the animals, and we followed them. And so following those animals and knowing certain things, we didn't just name things to be named after some person. It told a history. So looking to traditional place names and seeing how they might tell some history is one way of incorporating indigenous knowledge. I mentioned earlier how I helped with monitoring whitefish around the lake, and realizing that the fish camps are have helped. It's a symbiotic relationship with the whitefish. We have the fish camps. We put the scraps into the water, and it feeds the whitefish. And then in the winter times, we used to survive on whitefish if salmon ran out. And so there are many examples around Alaska. I've worked in different areas of Alaska where there are stories over and over again that align with some scientific research. So I think bringing together the two knowledges, it not only makes our studies stronger, it makes them more holistic, and it brings two different groups of people together and helps each other understand. And I think that's so valuable.
And anything else to add?
Well, what I was just thinking about when Danielle was sharing is that, you know, at ANSEP, our goal is to prepare students and to be successful in university. And so I think, too, there's like a lot of overlap with when you're growing up and you're getting ready to go out hunting or just be out on the land, you want to be prepared, right? You don't want to just go out and just be like, oh, I'm going to get what I need and then, you know, come home. Or you always prepare and you make sure you tell people where you're going. And so I think, you know, there's, I guess, that parallel with also being prepared for getting ready for college and university, and just like trying to apply those same concepts to academics.
Definitely, and looking at student success and how to make students stay in school and pursue higher education, but also the value of their indigenous teaching as well. And what helped you stay in school, both of you, stay in school and finish? And, you know, we were talking earlier about sparking an interest in STEM when you're little, but also just following it through and finishing college and then getting into a career. Go ahead.
Oh, we were just trying to figure out who should go first. So for me, I feel like I stayed in school and decided to pursue, you know, STEM degree, and then now I'm actually pursuing business, a master's in business administration. But for me, I feel like I try to have a bigger picture of things. And so I feel like one of my biggest values is community. And so when I graduated from high school, I knew that whatever I decided to pursue I somehow wanted to be able to give back to my community in some way. And, you know, that could be just being like an Alaska Native person, being from Unalakleet, being a part of ANSEP, which is a big community of mine. So I think just having that value and trying to think bigger than myself, I think that has helped motivate me to, you know, pursue my education and continue to pursue my education and to seek out opportunities where I can give back to people. Because I do feel like working with the middle school students from across the state, I'm able to, like, hopefully inspire them and get them excited about STEM so that, and then also just get them excited about also wanting to give back to their communities, because I feel like that's what they could do.
And that's definitely a key value across many tribes across the country, is that giving back and that sharing and coming home and helping your people in some way. Even if you are not working at home, there's also still ways to connect with your family and your community. And I know you wanted to add about how you finished school and studying and then followed your career path.
Thank you. So I did go to the University of Hawaii at Hilo. My first choice of degree was oceanography, but then I didn't want to be confined to the ocean. Realized I didn't want to, I get somewhat seasick on boats, so I switched to environmental science. And throughout my time in Hawaii, I had a hard time. Actually, there was some moments where I wanted to give up, but just being on the island and being so close to the culture, and the university I went to is one of the most diverse universities in the U.S. So we've got international students from all these different countries, and we've also got a huge science program. We've got language immersion, and so I think being so close to so many different cultures every week, or in almost every evening, there was a different cultural night. So there's different foods, and just having that community there really helped me to finish. And then each summer I would come back and do an internship. And one summer I did an internship in Denali and did an interp. So I took people out on hikes and shared some about the culture, and they weren't used to hearing about who the people were around Denali. And then in my final year of college, the summer, I did an internship in Costa Rica, where we went to three different biological stations, and we did our own study, and mine was on ants in this Piper plant and the symbiotic relationship between those, and really just zoning in on such a small creature in such a big forest was so amazing, because they're so strong and resilient, and they fight off these predators on this plant, and then this plant provides food for them. And so it was just like a small example of how we can interact with the environment and help protect it in ways, and then it provides for us. And I also did it semester abroad in Belgium in Brussels, which is a huge city. It was my first time abroad, and it opened my eyes further to how different countries are approaching climate change and the environment and stewarding the environment and changing their practices. And so coming back to Alaska and continuing my career in the sciences, mine has mostly been in fisheries, being in that community is so rewarding, because both of my parents are from fisheries places, the Yukon River and Bristol Bay. And so I think what I would say to the young women who are interested in sciences is remember why you pursued it in the first place. Remember that spark when you were young of why you were interested in anything. And for me, it was fish. I love fish, not just eating, but how they live and how all these different species rely on them, and then how they give back to the soil, they give to the trees, and remembering that spark of passion in your work, and remembering that everybody that you're working with had some spark of passion to start this in this place as well. And like Yosti, I did this career because of community. I also teach yoga on the side when I can. I also bead, and I love being part of the greater community and sparking people's own interests. And so I think remembering why we started on this path and remembering our community, and that it's whatever you're doing, you're being a part of something. And so,
and then coming and applying it back.
Yes.
So that's also part of it is, you know, oftentimes people get into a career or get a degree in something, and it's even as simple as, I know we think of stuff when we're in school maybe and think, oh, I'm never going to use this math, or I'm never going to use this, I don't need this. But there are real things happening today that are being discussed here on how to fix those things, or how to address those things, or even just how to look and see, look at past things that are happening and then moving forward, and including the environment. Our producer, Emily Schwing, got to speak with the tribal leader about some of the things that we're seeing right now when it comes to climate and the environment. Let's take a listen.
Oh, my name's Leo Lalnitz. I'm first chief of the Kaikuk tribe in Kaikuk, Alaska. 99754. It's right on the mouth of the Kaikuk River. It runs into the Yukon River. We haven't had really decent fishing since 2020, I think. 2019 was the last good fishing year. 2020, we got a few. But then that's when the crisis started happening in 2020. Now the next is zero to nothing, you know. Compared to what it used to be, it'd be thousands and hundreds of thousands of them running up the river now, and nothing. It's not a business deal, it's just more like subsistence, you know, fishing for the family, and that's about it. And my extended family, too, who can't go out and get it themselves, you know, like the elders or either unwed mothers or whatnot, or just even just help people in my village, really. That's the chief's job, anyway. Protect and serve his people.
I mean, that's really hard, too, when the price of gas is what it is, you know?
It is,
like,
yeah.
To take your boat out, or even to, you know, fuel up your four-wheeler if you've got to haul water, or go moose hunting, or if you're going out to haul wood or pick berries. Like, that's all very expensive.
That's all gas burning time. Every one of those activities you name, they're all consumed by gas. You know, you got to have gas to go somewhere. And that's our main highway on the river, winter and summer boats, you know. Wintertime we use the snow machine, but summertime it's river boats, you know. So that's, well, it is the highway, let's put it that way, whether it's marine or, you know. You can go about 30 miles to 8 gallons, something like that. That's a lot of fuel to be burning up.
That was a tribal leader. Our producer, Emily Schwing, got a chance to talk to you about not being able to fish and just how that impacts everyday life. There's a lot of people here just in conversations talking about the weather and the animals and everything that's being impacted, and looking to see how to address that. And I'm sure you're hearing things back home, and even from the, you know, definitely not only from people living in the city, but people who are out in the rural communities.
Definitely. Like, I feel like maybe we've been seeing these changes, though, for a while now, not just last year or this year, but, yeah, things have definitely been changing.
You were shaking your head listening to the tribal leader and just some of the things, talking about the fish.
Yeah, I worked with the Yukon River Drainage Fisheries Association for almost 3 years until 2018, and that was right before 2019 when we had so many fires, and there across the state there were salmon dying because of the creeks and rivers were so low, and the waters were so warm that they were just dying because it's the climate change and the fires here. I was in Anchorage. I think a lot of us experienced a lot of side effects of the constant smoke, and then living in Alaska, we don't have AC and it's so hot. And so I remember my nieces were only, they one of them wasn't even one, and the other was three. They didn't have AC, so they had to have water for pools. And I just think of some animals who also are experiencing it. They don't have AC either. There are so many moose in this area. Just a few weeks ago, we had a few stints of like 80 degrees, and there were moose in some areas, and they had just given birth. So they're trying to find food, and they're overheating, and also with traffic. So there was a mama moose and her calves in the backyard of my area, and so they didn't leave for a while, and she was so thin, and she needed to find food, but they were just so hot. And so we're feeling it not just in rural areas. I know there's fires in the lower Yukon right now, and fish declines, but there are also new species coming into Alaska, including smaller insects. And so we're rapidly feeling that. And like Yasti said, we've been feeling it before 2020. The numbers of the Yukon River salmon have been going down for some time, for a variety of reasons. And that we've seen this across the world. It happened in Europe, and then it's happened on the East Coast, and it happened in the Pacific Northwest. And so we're just really just hoping that it doesn't happen here, knock on wood, but it is, everybody is feeling a change.
And we did get a chance to talk to some people about the fires, fires burning not only in Alaska, but in the lower 48, in the West, in New Mexico. There's a lot of wildfires in Arizona. So our producer, Emily Schwing, was at NCAI talking to a bunch of different attendees. Let's hear what someone had to say about the fire.
I'm George Beams from St. Mary's with the Yupik-Wendrovsky tribe, one of the two tribes from St. Mary's. They address a lot of issues here, and there's a lot of intercommunication between each other, and that's why I think it's important. We get a lot of information, and we can seek some help when we do need in different areas that we need help in.
What are the issues that stood out to you?
Right now, it was mostly the climate change, you know. As you know, we're dealing with a fire, a pretty big fire at home, and I think that climate change has a lot to do with these fires that are popping up, and it's all over. It's just too dry.
Do you know if historically St. Mary's has dealt with fire before?
We have not as big as this. We've had quite a few fires right in town or around town.
Something that strikes me is, earlier you mentioned that it's just nice to be here because it's sharing of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
You're sharing your knowledge about how your community is responding to changing climate.
Oh, yeah.
Did you notice that?
No, I never thought of it. Yeah, no, it's just... But I see that now that you brought it up, you know.
Yeah.
I never paid attention to it.
You have knowledge to share now.
Yeah.
What's that like to realize?
Well, I don't know. It's just part of integrating, I guess, or communicating back and forth.
And that was one of the attendees talking about the fires and just the impacts of the fires. And it's a clear day, but earlier in the week it was definitely really, really smoky. And teaching about and talking about, the changing environment, and how do you get kids to consider that and look at, what plays into that?
I think it's through the opportunities that we're able to offer. Like I mentioned, at the middle school level, they start out with the middle school academy, and we expose them to a variety of different projects and activities. And then after they complete that, we actually invite them to come back to do career explorations. And so they get to do that every summer. They're in middle school. And, like, for example, for, like, the last couple of summers, well, not 2020, but the last – the other summers, like, we've been able to do, like, a marine science career exploration, and we have different people who've helped, host that. And so we have scientists that are actually talking to the students, and I think, you know, they're informing them. And I think our students are also aware, like, middle school students are pretty creative, clever, they're bright. So I think, you know, them having these opportunities early on to talk to scientists and to know about all these different issues is super important. And I think that's how, you know, it probably is going to be for a while. And, you know, having these types of things are important for these students to be able to make those changes.
I think I echo a lot of what Yossi had to share. Just sharing this knowledge and hearing from those who have made careers out of this. But I also am aware of the reality of the youth right now are being brought up in a different time than us. I mean, don't feel that old, but I know in middle school, when I was going to middle school, we had the dial-up, like, internet, and you had to go to the library. And so there's so much information right now that the youth have at their fingertips, which is so great. They can connect with people all around the world. But I do recognize that it can be overwhelming at times. And so I've talked to some youth who are overwhelmed and have shared, like, what is the use? What is not as the use? What is the why try? Because it's the climate is changing. And so recognizing the reality that there is a lot of harm happening in fires, but also the reality of that there are really good people working to change the way things are being done in a good way, and working to support sciences, and that they have a place in that if they want to, if they find interest in that, and also recognizing that this is their future as well.
And that's great. We're getting to the end of our hour, but what is the future like, and especially look like? What do you hope for the future, especially with Indigenous women getting into science?
This is Yosti, and I feel like I'm an optimist. I'm optimistic for the future, and I feel like working together and, you know, inspiring our youth to care about, you know, their communities, I think, you know, that gives me hope. So I'm optimistic, and yeah, like, Indigenous knowledge, it definitely has a big part to play, and I think, you know, it could be applied in everywhere.
I'm also optimistic and excited for what the future has to hold, but also aware of that there is so much that can be done, and there's so much potential. There's so many women and people working towards the greater good, but just as a reminder that to do good work, we also need to take care of ourselves too. And so I am also trying to do this. I'm a workaholic, and so I can overdo things and work to make change for the good, but also take time to go back on the land and take time to do the things you love. So I'm taking the week next week to go out on the land and be on the lake with youth, which I'm so excited for. So remembering to take time and enjoying the summer we have, and that will give us more energy for the work that we're doing in the future.
And is there any resources you could get out if there's some anybody listening today that from young people or even their parents or grandparents and thinking, hey, this would be a great resource for my granddaughter, my daughter, or anyone?
Yeah, definitely. So ANSEP, for all of our opportunities, we have a website. It's ANSEP.net, like a fishnet. So all of our opportunities are there. And like I said, we start working with students as young as, you know, middle school all the way up to the PhD level. So, you know, if there's anyone interested in STEM or just, you know, being, you know, excited about going to college or university, there's definitely opportunities with ANSEP that they should look into.
And anything you want to add?
So I work for the Wilderness Society. So the Wilderness Society's website is just tws.org. And so there's lots of opportunities there. One for the ones that are for youth are fellowships or internships. Right now we don't have any offered in Alaska, but we're hoping to, and those are usually offered in the summers, but there is opportunities in DC if people were interested in. And so we offer so many different internships around the US. And also, if you have any questions, Anchorage office is always open here in Anchorage.
Well, great. Thank you so much. They're coming to the end of our program today. Thank you so much to our guests, Yotsi Storms and Danielle Stickman. Thank you to our producer, Emily Schwing, and our volunteer, Rhonda Lovaldo, and KNBA, and all of our listeners for tuning in to our special broadcast of Alaska's Native Voice from the National Congress of American Indians. Alaska's Native Voice is a production of Quantic Broadcast Corporation, and this program is supported by the Climate Justice Resilience Fund. I'm your host, Antonia Gonzalez.